Okay, I'm going to call this meeting of House Finance to order. Today is Friday, May 16th, 2025, and the time is 3:23 p.m. And present, we've got Representative Allard, Representative Co-Chair Josephson, and myself, Representative Co-Chair Foster. Just a reminder, folks can mute their cell phones. And we do have three bills before us today, and I'll explain the fourth bill once we get more folks here. We've also got Representative Galvin here. We've got three bills. That's HB 193, unemployment benefits, paid parental leave. We've also got HB 104, that's address confidentiality program. And then we'll have, as our third bill, HB 96, that's the home care employment standards advisory board bill. Also, we've got Representative Hannon here as well. And so with that, I might just go ahead and Representative Co-Chair Shragi is also here. And then maybe once a few more people come in, I'll announce what we're doing with regard to SB 64, the elections bill. So with that, we'll go ahead and just get started. We've got Representative Tomaszewski here as well. And let's see, actually, we just about have a full complement. Representative Hall and your staff, Mr. Tristan Walsh, if you would please come to the table and introduce House Bill 193. Our plan is to take invited testimony. Looks like we've got Paloma Harbor for invited testimony, I believe. Is that right? Is that invited testimony or for questions? Invited testimony. And then from there, we've also got Mr. Trevor Storrs. Then we'll go to public testimony. We've got three fiscal notes. And then we'll take questions and then set the bill aside. So with that, Representative Hall, thanks for being here.
Thank you very much, Mr. Co-Chair. I appreciate this opportunity, and thank you, members of the House Finance Committee. Really appreciate being here to present House Bill 193. For the record, my name is Carolyn Hall, and I am representative for House District 16, which is West Anchorage and Sand Lake, Spinard, and Turnagain neighborhoods. I'm joined by my Chief of Staff, Tristan Walsh. So, House Bill 193 regarding paid parental leave and unemployment insurance updates. HB 193's origin began in an August 2024 Labor Trends magazine, where it was stated that the state of Alaska's unemployment insurance, or UI, trust fund is overfunded, while benefits lag behind their historic values. HB 193 would seek to solve this issue in an innovative way by also adopting model legislation to establish the Alaska Parental Leave Program and simultaneously update UI benefits for Alaskans. As the state seeks to recruit, attract, and retain young families, the paid parental leave policy would serve a crucial purpose, giving parents the time to bond with their child. By helping families take important time off for childbirth, adoption, or fostering, the state can ensure that parents and newborns can attend follow-up doctor's appointments, lower the risk for rehospitalization, have economic security that reduces stress on parents and children, further cement the bond between parents and an adopted child or foster youth, and help parents re-enter the workforce after any one of these scenarios. By building off existing infrastructure in the Department of Labor and Workforce Development, current employee and employer contributions can go towards an invaluable program that returns many benefits back to our society and economy, while also enhancing STEP, which is the State Training and Employment Program, and ensuring the long-term viability of the unemployment insurance Alaskans rely on in times of transition. So HB 193, the paid parental leave part of the bill, it creates a paid parental leave plan which covers adoption, fostering, and childbirth, or the placement of a child with a legal guardian through a tribal or state court. It gives the Department of Labor and Workforce Development the ability to set the paid parental leave duration between 8 and 26 weeks. It also creates an accelerated benefit where participants have the option to use two times the benefit schedule for half the duration. It also includes a tax cut for employers. And the big part of this is that none of this requires UGF. Additional changes to with 193 are it directs the Department of Labor to conduct actuarial studies on the paid parental leave fund every 2 years. It allows the Department of Labor to adjust the UI wage base and benefit for inflation. It adjusts the dependent benefit for inflation going from $23 a week to $72. And it increases the funding for STEP. And I'd like to note on this slide that there is a typo. It only increases the funding for STEP, not TVEP. And this was at the request of the Department of Labor. It increases the maximum taxable wage base to $85,000 a year and a maximum weekly benefit of $817. So before launching too deep into this slide, I just want to share a little bit of background. And that is, until 1993, there was no federal or national policy regarding family leave. The American Family Medical Leave Act, also known as FMLA, established job-protected absences for federal employees and employers with 50 employees within 75 miles of the business headquarters for 12 weeks. The result is that we effectively established unpaid family leave. The Alaska Family Medical Leave Act established 18 weeks of unpaid leave, which is also essentially job-protected absence for public employees. That is what the state of Alaska has. Paid parental leave is known to help improve the health and life outcomes of infants and parents of newborns and allows for bonding time with foster and adopted children. In 2019, President Trump amended the federal law, FMLA, to extend 12 weeks of paid parental leave regarding childbirth, adoption, and fostering for federal employees and military members. Alaska is in competition with many states for young, talented workers. Paid parental leave provides a well-known and valuable benefit at low cost and high benefit. All other states are pursuing these policies, and we cannot afford to be left behind. Paid parental leave allows parents to re-enter the workforce without being penalized. So paid parental leave, explained a little bit further, is according to the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, they estimate that 23% of employed women return to work within 10 days of giving birth, and yet 22% more return to work between 10 days and 40 days. Experts recommend that mothers need at least 6 weeks to recover from vaginal birth with no complications and 12 weeks for a C-section. And 66% of Alaska's households with children, all parents report working. The National Institute of Health estimates that on average, 24% of women exit the labor market in their first year of motherhood. 5 years later, the percentage drops to 17%, and after a decade, still 15% are absent. So the first step is to invest in kids and families. First off, what do we know? We know from decades of research that investment in early childhood development, from before birth through preschool, each dollar spent has an exponential return on that child's eventual success in society. Professor James Heckman is well known in early childhood research, and his foundational efforts demonstrate that the more investment a community makes in a child's early social and emotional well-being, the higher outcomes can be correlated with later in life. Generally, these are cited as anywhere between $13 and $16 return on every investment for $1 spent. This is calculated by the likelihood that the child performs well in school, has a lower likelihood for ACEs scores, and less likely to commit violent crime, and has a reduced chance of drug use or addiction. Paid parental leave can be a key way to achieve these high outcomes through existing infrastructure and policy. Studies show that there's a 51% decrease in odds of rehospitalization for mothers, as well as reduced incidences of postpartum depression. The National Partnership for Women and Families, a paid leave advocacy group, has extensive research on the benefits of this type of leave. The months before and immediately after birth are formative in an infant's development, and paid maternity leave improves the health and outcomes of infants and parents. Research has shown, amongst other benefits, paid family leave to a reduction, excuse me, research has shown amongst other benefits that paid leave leads to a reduction in low birth weight and preterm births, especially for Alaska Native and African American mothers. Positive associations are also correlated with paid parental leave for reductions in stress and an increase in exercise, which are both critical for new mothers. Fathers are more likely to report a greater engagement in children's lives, boosting cognitive and developmental benefits for children. And fathers who take paid leave are more likely to live longer. So the bottom line is, paid leave is a well-studied and well-regarded policy that allows young families to grow and thrive without suffering economic hardships. By providing paid leave, we know that we can ensure that infants are more likely to get follow-up appointments, mothers are less likely to suffer from postpartum depression, and fathers are better able to bond with their family. Most workers in the U.S. do not have paid leave through their jobs, and that includes approximately 75% of Alaskans, or approximately 270,000 people in our state. Unpaid leave under the federal FMLA Act is inaccessible for 68% of Alaskans. If Alaskan women participated in the labor force at the same rate as women in countries with paid leave, there would be approximately 8,000 additional workers in Alaska and nearly $314 million more wages earned statewide. Women are 47% of Alaska's workforce, and 28% of business owners are women. Paid parental leave can reduce working women's reliance on public assistance and SNAP by as much as 40% compared to women who do not have this benefit. In states that implemented paid leave, such as New York, businesses reported significantly easier time managing long absences. Two-thirds of businesses report that they manage the absence by temporarily reassigning the work. Studies in California found small businesses saw a 14% decrease in per worker labor costs when workers took paid leave. The smallest businesses had the greatest percentage-based savings. In California, 92% of businesses reported that paid leave had a positive impact on employee turnover, and workers who have access to paid leave are more likely to return to work than drop out of the labor pool. It helps workers maintain their salary levels, meaning over time they can earn more and can contribute to the households and to the overall economy. Turnover at small businesses costs approximately 23.5% of that worker's annual wage and can go as high as 150% of your worker's annual salary as a vacancy goes on. Paid leave can dramatically increase employee retention for businesses. Studies have found that firms implementing these policies have greater revenue and profit per full-time equivalent employee. Technology companies saw a $2.64 return for every $1 invested, and manufacturers saw a $2.57 return for every $1 invested. A recent study found that workers with paid leave are 22% more likely to recommend their job to a friend who does not have that benefit. And polling found that Gen Z workers identified paid leave as the number one policy they consider when relocating for work. So what are other states doing? With no national policy in place, many states are pursuing their own policies. And for Alaska, HB 193 is one such policy. In a competitive labor market, one way for Alaska to affordably attract employees into the public and private sectors would be a paid leave policy. Currently, we only have job-protected absences. According to MetLife, which offers variety insurance products, including paid family leave, 199 bills were introduced in 36 states last year. By next year, when Delaware, Minnesota, Maine, and Maryland programs are online, approximately 59% of U.S. civilian workers will have access to some form of paid family leave. Currently, 24 states offer some sort of paid family leave or paid parental leave plan or are in the process of implementing one. Of those 36 states, three states passed paid leave bills. That was Kentucky, Tennessee, and South Carolina. 17 states considered expanding or changing their existing paid leave programs, and 16 states considered but did not pass such legislation. Now, turning to the unemployment insurance part of HB 193. Unemployment insurance is wage replacement for when you are unemployed and looking for work. It was established in 1935 by President Roosevelt in the Social Security Act. Another type of wage replacement, such as short-term disability, is widely available. However, there's a limited application available for family purposes beyond pregnancy complications. Public and private employers are familiar with unemployment insurance and payroll processes and those deductions. The state of Alaska requires employers to collect this on behalf of employees. The employee contribution is unique amongst many states, and in this bill, it's reappropriated towards paid parental leave. So Alaska is basically one of three states that has an employee contribution. It is so HB 193 would establish a separate fund where employees where an employee's contribution is held for the collection of a claim. So currently, this is what the unemployment insurance flow chart looks like. It's funded through two sources. The employer and employee both pay a contribution that feeds into the UI trust fund. Alaska is one of the, like I said, Alaska is one of three states that requires the employee to pay a contribution. The other two states are New Jersey and Pennsylvania. Currently, the state of Alaska also funds STEP and TVEP through a 0.10% and 0.25% special employee contribution from the employee. So the 0.1% goes to STEP and 0.25% goes to TVEP. The state of Alaska denotes these as a special contribution, which are separate from the contributions required for the UI Trust Fund. So what does HB 193 propose to do with these contributions? For paid parental leave, it would create a paid parental leave fund using these two existing DGF fund sources in state statute. The bill creates a special employer contribution and special employee contribution, both going towards a new paid parental leave fund. Going from top to bottom on the right side of this slide, STEP and TVEP would continue to see their existing 0.35% special contributions from employees. The employee would see a special contribution of 0.15% directed towards the paid parental leave fund rather than the UI fund. Then, based on actuarial analysis performed by the Department of Labor, if the department decides to implement a special employer contribution, the department shall collect from employers 0.10% for STEP and 0.20% for the paid parental leave fund. Of the remaining 0.7% employer contribution to the UI Trust Fund, the department shall have the authority to lower the employer contributions down to 0.50%, and that is to be determined on an actuarial basis. If the department believes the fund is solvent, meaning the UI fund is solvent, and such an action is not inconsistent with their mandate, this would effectively create a 0.20% tax cut for employees based on the solvency of the UI Trust Fund. These special employer contributions are found on page 12 of the bill. The language creates a snapback feature where if the department determines that, for example, in the case of a recession or a severe recession, depression, or, God forbid, another pandemic, the UI fund is approaching a fund balance or reserve ratio they consider unhealthy, the department may redirect employer contributions back towards UI. This self-writing feature is similar to other protections for the UI fund, where the department has the authority to ensure fund solvency. And with that, I'm happy to take questions if that is the will of the committee. We also have references that can be shared upon request. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Great. Thank you very much. We're going to go right into the invited testimony, public testimony, fiscal notes, and then we'll come back for questions. So also would like to recognize that we have in the audience, I believe Representative Prax is here for his bill. We also have Representative Fields and Representative Eichheide joining us today. Thanks for being here. Also, we have from the very start of the meeting Representative Jimmy and Representative Bynum and Representative Johnson. And then let's see here. We'll go right into invited testimony. So with that, if I could have Ms. Paloma Harbor and Mr. Lennon Weller come up, both from the Department of Labor. We do have a conference committee at 4 o'clock, so our conferees will step out, but I think we'll continue on with our presentation for a little bit. At some point, we'll probably do a recess sometime after 4 o'clock at some point. So with that, if you could put yourself on the record, thanks for being here.
Okay. For the record, Paloma Harbor. I am the director for the Division of Employment and Training Services with the Department of Labor and Workforce Development.
Good afternoon, chairs, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lennon Weller, and I'm an economist with the Department of Labor and Workforce Development, and I function as the actuary for the unemployment insurance system.
So we had done some slides to show the impact of the trust fund, or we did some, we thought we did, some slides to show the impact of the trust fund of the current version of House Bill 193. But I'm not seeing them here, so we'll speak to it just a little bit and keep it short and simple. So what we did was we got a copy, or with the legislation, we looked at historic
economic. Excuse me, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hammond.
Can we confirm that these are the slides you're referring
correct.
To?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
About them. So let me just speak to them in general terms. What we did is we looked at historical downturns in the economy, like what happened with the COVID pandemic and the Great Recession that happened a bit ago. And we took it to an extreme. We said, what if we did three times what we're currently experiencing in benefit costs? And right now that's about almost, I'll say $45 million a year, almost $50 million a year. So in an extreme case, that would go up to at the highest extreme, it goes up to $350 million. Again, we just wanted to see how the trust fund would handle a significant recession with the changes in this bill. So, again, with the changes in this bill, unemployment benefits are significantly increased from where they are right now. So we wanted to ensure, and employer and employee contributions are now going to other funds than the unemployment trust fund. So we wanted to ensure that the system would still work in an extreme situation. And it does. At the lowest point, we would have a reserve ratio in the fund of about 0.5%. And so it does show that in an extreme situation, we might come lower than some people might be comfortable with. But the system itself would set employer tax rates to then catch back up, and the trust fund would become healthy. Again, that's that first chart, the one that you have. It shows the reserve ratio. And what the reserve ratio is, I'm sorry, I didn't say this. It's the amount in the trust fund as compared to kind of the target that we would want in the trust fund. And maybe Lennon could speak to that. Can you explain the reserve ratio?
Absolutely.
Mr. Weller, if you could put yourself on the record.
Again, for the record, Lennon Weller, economist of the Department of Labor. The reserve ratio is a measure of the trust fund balance at any given point in time as a percentage of the wages covered by the program. In statute and through historical experience, we target between 3 and 3.3% of wages to equate to what we would consider full solvency, meaning recession ready or ready to absorb any sort of projected type of historical claim load that we might expect. For reference, at the moment, we're right around a 4.7% reserve ratio, so we're significantly above our target.
So again, looking at this bill, again, for the record, Paloma Harbor, even in a more extreme circumstance than we have experienced, the trust fund would adjust and be able to accommodate the proposal. So that's kind of what all these pictures tell you. They just tell it to you in a slightly different way.
Okay. We've got questions. Representative Tomaszewski.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster, through the chair. Thank you for coming before us today. Isn't there a cap on the amount of payments that we could possibly see distributed through this fund? Is there an anticipated cap?
Through the chair, Representative Tomaszewski, just so I can understand the question or ensure that I'm understanding it, currently, in current statute, the maximum we distribute in a benefit to an individual, is that what you're looking for, is $370 per week. So a maximum of $370 per week per claimant. And this bill, as proposed, would increase that to $817 per individual per week. Is that?
And a follow-up.
Follow-up.
And so how many individuals could possibly, there's an average of how many babies are born in Alaska every year. And so I would assume that you would take that average and maybe come up with some kind of a number that would anticipate the usage. I know, I would imagine not everyone, I mean, not every mother's working, so they probably wouldn't qualify for it, but I'm sure there's an average number of babies born every year, and then what that possible payout could look like.
Through the chair, Representative Tomaszewski, we did a very rough estimate of the number of births. Remember when you did the total number of births, it was about, can you remember the number?
It was about
9,000. 9,000 babies born. And we assumed one parent claiming for the full 26 weeks, like let's say they really did take off the full 26 weeks allowed, what that would mean as far as the amount of money in the fund you would have to have. So, again, an extreme circumstance now for the paid family leave program. Now I'm not talking about unemployment anymore. And that scenario would, I think, cost us $175 million. Is that what you said? In the most extreme circumstance. On average, people take about 8 or 10 weeks of leave, usually, when they have a baby. And so we ran that analysis we thought it would be a better analysis to say how many people, females specifically, at what age range. So we took that and we said, okay, we have 12,449 women in the age group of 15 to 19, and they've got a fertility rate of 62.3 per 100,000. So that's, let's say, 776 births. So we did a fairly in-depth analysis. We could share this table with the group to give you an estimate of what it might cost. And we went anywhere from
100% of births here.
46.8 million down to maybe 12 million, depending on the scenario.
Okay, and a follow-up.
Follow-up.
So does this legislation bar both parents from claiming?
Through the chair, Representative Tomaszewski, it does not. In fact, this better analysis that we did, or that I think is more sound actuarially, it assumes both parents, both males and females claiming.
Okay, that'd be great if the committee could get copies of those assumptions.
Thank you. We can do that.
And what's the name of the study again, Ms. Arbor? The study is called a
an actuarial analysis. I don't know that that's actually accurate because we don't have actuals to base this on. It's all assumptions.
I just noticed you nudged Mr. Weller. It looks like that was an inside joke of how to correctly pronounce that, I assume.
Yes. Thank you.
Before I go, so on the list, I've got Representative Hannon, Eller, and Galvin. We did get a late start to our meeting. I realize that the public has been waiting for some public testimony, so I'd like to jump over to them. We've only got three people, one more invited and two from the public. So feel free to stay there. I think there are going to be more questions for you, or you're welcome to sit back if you want as well. We're going to go. I'm going to, well, before I open public testimony, let's go to our other public invited testifier, and that's Mr. Trevor Storrs. Mr. Storrs, if you can put yourself on the record.
Committee and CEO of the Alaska Children's Trust. So at the Trust, our mission is to prevent child abuse and neglect by addressing root causes and strengthening protective factors. We focus on primary prevention, proactively building the systems and the policies and various supports that help families thrive long before harm ever occurs. And by investing in those conditions that allow children and families to be safe, stable, and connected, we can actually prevent abuse and neglect from happening in the first place. And one of the key ways to prevent child abuse and neglect is by ensuring families have the time and the resources they need to care for their loved ones without risking their financial stability. That's why a comprehensive statewide paid family and medical leave policy is one of our top priorities, and it is primary prevention. HB 193 provides an important opportunity for Alaska to build a proactive system of support that actually strengthens families before challenges escalate into crises that we face every day. To be clear, when we say comprehensive, we need a paid leave policy that supports families through three key types of leave: bonding, or that maternal leave, which involves caring for a new child; family leave, or caring for a loved one with serious health condition; and medical leave, which is addressing the worker's own serious health needs. 14 states with paid family medical leave have embraced a comprehensive model that includes all three types of leave. Research consistently shows that paid family and medical leave is a smart primary prevention strategy that benefits families, the economy, and the state budget alike. By giving workers the time to care for themselves and their loved ones without risking financial stability, paid leave strengthens protective factors that prevent child abuse and neglect while also driving broader economic gains. So, for example, access to paid leave is linked to improved child and maternal health outcomes, including higher vaccination rates, reduced rates of low birth rate, weight, and lower maternal depression. Families with access to paid leave are less likely to rely on public assistance programs, easing strain on state-funded safety nets. For example, in California, paid family leave reduced reliance on public assistance by 14% among low-income mothers. From an economic perspective, paid leave increases workforce participation and retention. Nationally, women are 20% more likely to stay employed a year after childbirth if they have paid leave, which boosts household income and tax revenues. Employers benefit from the reduced turnover and improved employee productivity, while the broader economy gains from a more stable and engaged workforce. From the state perspective, this means fewer downstream costs in health care, child welfare, and public assistance, translating to that long-term savings for the state budget. Every dollar invested in prevention reduces future expenditures on crisis response. Paid family medical leave is not just a benefit for families. It's a fiscal responsible policy that actually strengthens Alaska's workforce, supports that economic growth, and reduces costly social outcomes. We deeply appreciate the leadership of the bill sponsor and the work of the House Labor and Commerce Committee to advance this critical conversation. This bill focuses on parental leave, provides a strong foundation for our paid leave policy. Not long ago, this type of policy would have never been discussed in the halls of the legislature, so we applaud and celebrate it. At the same time, as we support this foundation wholeheartedly, we would be remiss not to take this opportunity to provide ideas of how to build upon this foundation. One opportunity is to strengthen the bill is to consider expanding the scope of leave beyond just parental bonding to include medical and family caregiving needs. Medical leave is essential to ensure mothers have time to recover from childbirth and manage pregnancy-related complications, especially given that recovery often takes longer than bonding leave allows. Without this, parents may be forced to return to work too soon, not only risking their health, but also their baby's well-being and increasing health care costs. Plus, Alaskans often need to care for an older child with complex illness, supporting an aging parent, or even manage their own serious health conditions. Including these types of leave would better reflect the real-life needs of Alaskan families and workers. Even adding a modest number of weeks for medical leave would take the program more comprehensive, providing critical support while aligning with best practices in other states. In addition to expanding the scope of leave, another opportunity could be build upon the strong foundation of this bill is ensuring the ability of employers to offer additional paid leave to workers and for these benefits to be easily coordinated. These private and public partnerships exist in other states, and we'd be happy to share examples of how other states have successfully coordinated these efforts to better support families and businesses. And lastly, we would like to offer a program and cost modeling analysis for the committee to be considered that will support a more dynamic policy that includes various tiered options for adjusting policy levers, such as the number of weeks and percentage of wage replacement. The modeling is done using a paid leave microsimulator designed by the U.S. Department of Labor to help support states in developing their paid leave policies. uses the labor data and information about current use of job protected leave within Alaska to determine likely take-up rates for paid leave programs. This information is combined with wage data and various policy choices to help determine program costs. The simulation model has been benchmarked against actual program costs and has been widely used by policymakers and advocates across the country. This type of model can help ensure Alaska's paid leave program is accessible to families at various income levels while also designing a policy that is fiscally responsible and sustainable. We're happy to engage in further conversation with committee members to support these efforts. This type of comprehensive statewide paid medical and family leave policy, a policy that extends beyond bonding leave to encompass a broader range of family medical needs, has been adopted by several states across the country, and there's bipartisan legislation being considered by many more. It fits especially well with a public insurance model like the one in House Bill 193, as it has the potential to benefit all workers in Alaska over the course of their careers. A comprehensive statewide paid family medical leave program is an investment in Alaska's families, children, and communities, and our businesses. We greatly appreciate the sponsor's leadership in advancing this important conversation and the committee's thoughtful consideration of how to make this policy work best for Alaska. Thank you for your time and this opportunity to contribute to this important discussion, and we look forward to continuing to work together to build a program that supports Alaska's future.
Thank you very much, Mr. Storrs. I'm going to open up public testimony on House Bill 193, Unemployment Benefits, Paid Parental Leave. And if folks would like to submit written testimony, they can do so by emailing us at house.finance@akleg.gov. I'll repeat that after we hear from the two public testifiers. And is there anyone in the room who would like to testify? Just double checking. I don't see anyone. Okay. Online, we've got Julie Cleeton calling in from Wasilla. Ms. Cleeton, if you can state your name and your affiliation.
Hello. My name is Julie Cleeton, and I chair the Alaska Public Health Association's Policy Committee. We support paid parental leave. Since 2013, the American Public Health Association has advocated for paid sick leave and family leave policies. They cite several well-studied benefits of parental leave, including fewer preterm births, reductions in C-section deliveries, more well baby visits, decreased infant mortality, longer periods of breastfeeding, and improved mental health of new mothers. In some studies, these positive effects are identified only when the parental leave is paid. Parental leave can be life-saving, and investments in early childhood pay huge dividends for society later in life. On behalf of the Alaska Public Health Association, I urge you to pass this paid parental leave bill. And like the Alaska Children's Trust, we would also support future expansions to family and medical leave. Speaking only for myself now, I'd love to see this bill pass quickly. I'm 31, I earn the primary income for my family, and I've been saving up vacation days for years so I can afford to have what my co-workers jokingly call maternity vacation. Most workers can't do that. And even if we can, we shouldn't have to sacrifice years' worth of earned vacation time and postpone parenthood. Thank you, representatives, for your time and consideration.
Thank you very much, Ms. Cleeton. I don't see any questions, so we're going to go over to Mike Coons, calling in from Wasilla. If you can state your name and your affiliation.
Yeah, my name is Mike Coons from Wasilla, and I'm speaking for myself. I oppose HB 193. The Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund is overfunded in part because more people are working, or those who lost jobs have left the state, or out of the workforce and now on welfare or Medicaid, or like myself, retired. Being overfunded is a good thing, knowing we have ups and downs in our workforce. From a Google search, I found, quote, it's difficult to pinpoint an exact number of businesses in Alaska offering maternity leave, as it's often a company-specific benefit, not a mandated requirement across the board. However, the Alaska Family Medical Leave Act, AFLA, does require state employers with over 25 employees to provide job-protected absence for up to 18 weeks for employees dealing with pregnancy, childbirth, or adoption. The Federal Family and Medical Leave Act, FMLA, also offers unpaid leave for qualified employees at covered companies, but it doesn't mandate paid leave, end quote. This bill will pay from the unfunded unemployment fund, and it is unclear as to if ballot measure one that passed last year may have an, may or will have an impact as well. Thus, an employee gets unemployment, then the employer may have to pay under ballot measure one at least this person is now double dipping. This negates any tax cut mentioned in the sponsor's statement. Then in fiscal note three, quote, revenue into the new parental leave fund comes from the diversion of employee contributions to the unemployment insurance system equivalent to 0.15% of taxable wages. This, end quote. This adds more questions. I read this as an increased tax on the employee. The Department of Labor has a solid number of those working. The revenue from the employer and the employee tax so that the insurance trust fund continues being solvent. This will cloud the facts of future payouts to unemployed and unemployed by adding maternity leave. This will draw down the fund, and when we have a spike in unemployment, the fund may not be able to pay out to those who have paid in. Vote no on HB 193. Thank you.
Okay. I don't see any questions for Mr. Coons. Thank you very much. Is there anyone else online who would like to testify? I believe everybody else is with Department of Labor or Department of Administration. Is there anyone else who would like to testify? I don't think so. So with that, let's see, Mr. Storrs was invited testimony, so I will go ahead and close public testimony on House Bill 193, Unemployment Benefits. And maybe if we could first direct questions, I know that there are two hands that popped up for Mr. Trevor Storrs. And then after that, we'll go back to Ms. Paloma Harbor. So with that, Representative Bynum and then Galvin. Representative Bynum. Okay, Representative Galvin for Mr. Storrs.
Sure. Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Through the chair, Mr. Storrs, thank you very much for your very extensive testimony. And I just want to make sure there are a couple things I'm not sure I was tracking as I was taking notes. You mentioned that in general, we're very supportive in terms of all of the ways that we can see and imagine protective factors, but the things that you mentioned that we might have more conversation about, I believe I heard you say that this is inclusive of, that you would support something that is inclusive of the maternal leave. I think maybe that meant the bonding leave. And then did you mention, you said there were three different kinds of paid leave that you would like to see this bill include, and I want to make sure I heard all three. I think there was bonding, family, and medical, but I'm not sure.
Through the chair, Representative, this again for the record, Trevor Storrs with the Children's Trust. You are correct. The three types were the bonding or parental leave that this bill specifically focuses on, which we greatly applaud and are excited to see and stand very much next to and arm in arm with this. But if we had our dream come true, we would also love to see it more aligned with like the FMLA and look at the other two, which is family leave, or as we know, caring for a loved one with a serious health condition, and then medical leave, which is addressing the worker's own serious health needs.
Thank you. And through the chair, would that mean post-birth medical issues? For example, if it was vaginal versus, I guess that's what I'm thinking about, is that there, I know that sometimes there can be complications with delivery, and are you referring to that when you talk about medical leave?
Yes. Well, my apologies again to the chair, this is Trevor Storrs with the Children's Trust. You are correct. So the medical leave would be two things. One, having some weeks in on dealing with the recovery after birth. Not all births are easy and can be complicated. I would have to look up research of how many we have here in Alaska, but we do know that there are complications, whether we're talking C-section or other aspects that can delay the healing process after giving birth.
But there's also just medical leave, whether we're talking cancer or other disability conditions on a medical level.
Thank you. Follow-up?
Follow-up.
Thank you. And you referred to four states embracing family leave, and I'm not sure if you meant – 14. Are there 14 states embracing all three of these categories or some of them?
Through the chair, again, Trevor Storrs of the Children's Trust, 14, that does a comprehensive, and they do all three.
Okay, and I have one other follow-up, if I may.
Galvin?
Actually, this might be better asked of the makers. The question is whether how let's see how I can phrase this right. Co-chair, I'm curious to know, with the passage of the federal family leave only for federal employees, what pieces of these three components that are considered best practices were included in that leave?
And you think who best to answer
I'm hoping that, perhaps Mr. Storrs knows, but if not, I think that might be a better question for the maker, which we could deliver later if he doesn't know.
Mr. Storrs?
Through the chair, could you repeat that question, Representative, please?
Yes. Of the three family leave categories that you mentioned were best practices, what is inclusive of the Federal Family Leave Act, as we know it, for federal workers? Does it include all three of these?
Through the chair, again, this is Trevor Storrs with Children's Trust. Yes, those are, if you look at FMLA, they cover that.
And I have one last question for Mr. Storrs.
Sure. Representative Galvin.
Mr. Storrs, would you have any knowledge around what the general number of weeks is considered best practices for the bonding period in terms of what we've seen other states get past?
Again, through the chair, this is Trevor with the Storrs with the Children's Trust. I would need to look specifically, I think best practices, if we actually look at it, they actually recommend up to a year if we look at other countries to be direct and honest. But best practices of what we are seeing in the states, it's usually on closer to around the 12-week mark.
Thank you.
Okay. Okay, any other questions for Mr. Storrs? Okay, thank you. We're going to go back to questions for Ms. Harbor as well as Mr. Weller. And on the list, I've got Representative Hannon, Allard, and Galvin. Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Ms. Harbor, Mr. Weller, how long has it been since the state of Alaska has increased its unemployment insurance benefits?
Again, for the record, Paloma Harbor with the Department of Labor, through the chair, Representative Hannon. The last time it was updated was in state legislative year 2009 for calendar year 2010. Is that accurate? Or
calendar year 2009.
I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. SLA 2008.
And follow-up?
Follow-up.
And so the maximum benefit to any employee in Alaska since 2010 for wage replacement has been $370, whether you are making $45,000 a year or $145,000 a year. The maximum benefit was $370 per week. Correct?
Through the chair, that is correct.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Allard.
Thank you. And this is for Director Harbor. I'm kind of naive to this part of our benefits. So I'm going to ask a couple of questions to lead into probably where I'm going to go. Is that okay, Co-Chair?
Representative Ballard.
Thank you. So you gave the number to Representative Hannon just now about what they get per week. It's kind of similar with the FMLA. You have to use all your leave, sick leave, and then you can still remain on leave as long as it's approved, but it's not paid. With the state, can you tell me how it works? For the record, so everybody knows.
Through the chair, Representative Allard, there's not currently a program, so we don't. It doesn't work anyway right now. The bill proposes up to 26 weeks, and it it would be consecutive, I believe.
Okay. So right now, if someone was to have a baby, mm-hmm. if a woman was to have a baby and she didn't have any leave, that individual would just be taking leave without pay? Is that what we're looking at?
Through the chair, Representative Ellard, currently, if an individual doesn't have some paid leave from their employer, then yes, it would be leave without pay.
Okay. The fiscal note, may I?
Sure. Representative
Ellard. It's huge. So can you explain to me how we would cover this with the circumstances that the state is in currently?
Through the chair, Representative Ellard, the way that this program will be funded is through basically instead of paying into unemployment insurance, which is now a requirement for both employees and employers, a portion of what they would have given to unemployment insurance will now go towards this paid family leave program, paid parental leave program. And so it's not it's not a cost to the general fund, it's a cost to the trust fund.
Okay. So may I?
Representative Ballard.
Can the trust fund afford this every single year?
Through the chair, Representative Ellard, the trust fund can currently afford this and could afford this into the future given our current economy with the wages and the benefit claims we're experiencing and everything. The concern would be in the model that we did portray to you all a significant recession. And again, the system could adjust to it. What it would mean, I think as the one testifier indicated, would be an overall increase in taxes because we would need to increase unemployment taxes to cover a recession potentially. So the system is built to handle adjustments like that, but it could have an impact if there was a significant recession.
Representative Ellard?
I haven't totally gotten into the bill, so my question would be like, couldn't we, as policymakers, have you looked at the numbers of how it would just be beneficial to follow what the federal government does with FMLA?
Through the chair, Representative Ellard, my understanding is that FMLA is unpaid leave mm-hmm. and that there's not a paid leave
right.
at the federal level.
Right. So with Absolutely. The federal government, it's you take your leave, then you take your sick leave, and when it's all gone, people can donate to you, and then you have leave without pay. So that's kind of currently what we have right now, right?
Through the chair, Representative Ellard, that's my understanding.
Interesting. Okay, thank you.
Okay. In the lineup, I've got Representative Galvin and Bynum. Representative Galvin. Okay. Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. I appreciate bringing the bill forward. I definitely know that we got some homework to do here. There's a 7-page sectional with 5 sections. Very complicated, obviously, when we start talking about medical leave. We talk about the unemployment trust, 27-page bill. I was hoping that maybe at some point we might be able to get something that will break down the benefit a little bit easier for us to kind of look at, something that we'd be able to look at that kind of shows a comparable chart. Something like if you were giving it to the employee and said, here's what your benefit is, that would be somewhat helpful. Right now that the bill is saying that it's 8 to 26 months, can you talk a little bit about what, or I'm sorry, weeks? Yeah, months. Well, that would be a heck of a benefit, wouldn't that? 8 to 26 weeks. Can you talk a little bit about what would trigger how you define what length of time that you'd be eligible for? And just some, if it requires complicated formulas, maybe just a couple quick examples might be helpful.
And before we get too far away, Mr. Walsh, are you wanting to clarify something from the previous question, and then we'll address this one? Mr. Walsh, if you can put yourself on the record.
For the record, Tristan Walsh, staff to Representative Hall. Through the chair, Representative Ellard, your question regarding FMLA and its status as a paid benefit under the 2019 National Defense Authorization Act by President Trump, that actually established for federal employees and for members of the military up to 12 weeks of paid leave for childbirth, adoption, and fostering.
Thank you. Representative Ballard.
Thank you. I think the bill is probably great. I was going to suggest, because the military does a sort of quirky thing too, I like the 12-week portion. I'm just putting this out there for you guys to think about. And I like it aligning with the way FMLA is doing with the government. I think it's fair. I was in the military at the time, so I know how this all plays with the FMLA and leave and parenting and stuff. Just throwing that out there with you guys. Okay, thank you.
Ms. Harbor, regarding Representative Bynum's question.
Again, for the record, Paloma Harbor with the Department of Labor. Can you remind me of the question? Oh. I'm sorry.
Sure. Thank you. Through the chair, it says in the write-up and within the bill, it says 8 to 26 weeks.
Sure.
I was just trying to, without going into in-depth detail and a better understanding of exactly how the mechanisms work, I was hoping to get a kind of an explanation of, like, how would an employee, you know, when they're qualifying for this, that they qualify for 8 weeks or 10 weeks or 26 weeks. And if it's a complicated formula, just some brief examples would be helpful.
Okay. Through the chair, Representative Bynum, it's a good question. In fact, the legislation, one of the changes made in this most recent version is that the department annually will decide, based on the health of the paid family leave fund, how many weeks a claimant could be eligible for. So it could be anywhere. We could set the limit, the maximum, at 8 weeks, and we could set that maximum at 26 weeks. So that just sets how many weeks a claimant could do. In the beginning, just speaking frankly, if we were administering this program while the fund was growing, we would probably say we're going to go with the minimum until we have enough money in the trust or in the fund, the parental leave fund, to know that it couldn't handle the benefit load that comes in. So let's say it was 8 weeks. Everybody would be eligible for the 8 weeks, but they would be eligible for a certain dollar amount based on the wages they were already earning in their base year. So that's what would differ based per person. How much you could get would be different. And those that opt to, if you are a claimant and you come in, you could go for 8 weeks, or you could opt to only claim 4 weeks, in which case you'd get double the benefit payment if you choose to opt into the 4 week benefit schedule.
Thank you.
Follow-up? Representative Bynum?
So I thought I was looking in here, and there was a portion here which talks about eligibility. Mm-hmm. And I believe it said that you had to have at least $2,500 of paid income within two quarters, I believe. Can you talk a little bit about the eligibility of what an employee would kind of pay into this thing, and then how would they be eligible for the benefit?
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, the way the bill's written currently, the eligibility is really actually based on unemployment eligibility. So if you've been employed in what we call your base period or base year, we look at wages for, you have an incident. Let's say you have a baby, right? And that baby was born on January 2nd. I'll use a second. We would look at your wages for four quarters, the first four quarters of the five quarters preceding that birth. So you have the baby June 2nd. We'd look at the, not the most recent quarter, but the four quarters prior. And we'd look at your wages during that time period. And that would be how we determine if you've earned $2,500 in that period over the course of two different quarters, then you would be eligible.
Representative Bynum?
And so then your payment that you'd be eligible for would basically be a percentage of the wages that you were earning, but then there's a minimum, correct?
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, yes. The minimum is that $2,500. If you're below $2,500, your benefit is $0, so you're not eligible. But between $2,500 and $2,750, it's $56. That schedule is found in Section 5 of the bill.
The very end, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Okay.
I had a couple other quick ones, if it's okay.
Okay, Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair mm-hmm. Foster. So when I think about this, the first thing I think about is large employers a large employer's ability to absorb this law being enacted upon them. So you've got a large employee base. You have one of your employees is celebrating the life of a child. Their ability to have the loss of that employee for up to 6 months, effectively, under this law, they might be able to do. But what about employers that are small employers? So if I have only two employees and one of them is going to be using this benefit, how would that employer be impacted?
For the record, Tristan Walsh, staff to Representative Hall. Representative Bynum, through the chair, that was actually one of the things that we were really interested in terms of this realm of policy. As small businesses seek to compete with much larger employers, this is actually a problem that they are already facing, where they're fighting for the same pool of employees. They're trying to recruit and retain them. If someone's trying to start a family, then that can be a significant barrier for a small business in terms of planning. This helps create a planned process for that using the existing contributions that employer is already paying into the UI system effectively. So they're able to create a benefit that helps them, in fact, compete with larger employers. And we have a couple slides on that in our PowerPoint, and we'd be happy to get the references to you regarding the feedback other states have seen from small businesses as they implement these policies.
Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. So I'm hoping I'm not misunderstanding what you're saying. What I hear you saying is you're talking about the actual cost to the employer. What I'm actually talking about is that if I've got two employees and now one of them is going to be out for 6 months, that has a tremendous impact to what I'm going to do. So I'm either now going to go find a temporary employee to try to hire them for 6 months, which is very difficult in some of the climate that we have, or I'm just – and I can't replace them, right? So, I mean, it has a tremendous impact on that employer. So I was just trying to get a better idea of if has this been thought out and what is, you know, how are we going to be impacting those small businesses?
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, Paloma Harbor again for the record, and this is outside my area of expertise, but my understanding is that this legislation does not expand the workers' entitlement to leave. So currently in Alaska Family Leave Act, you can take up to 18 weeks and your job is preserved. I believe that's still accurate, even under this. So the employer might be able to let you be out for 26 weeks and you could claim under this benefit program, but that doesn't hold you to an entitlement. Does that make sense?
Mr. Walsh?
For the record, Tristan Walsh, staff to Representative Hall. To build on what Director Harbor just mentioned, one of the things that we've also seen in states that have implemented these sorts of policies is that the barriers to reentry for the workforce, especially for women, are reduced. And so as employee job satisfaction goes up, they're able to return to work. And so for small businesses, it can be a benefit. And it's certainly something larger employers face when they see the cost regarding recruitment and retention as well.
Co-Chair, I think Representative Stapp might have had an input that would be helpful, but I did have a follow-up.
I just wanted to also recognize that Representative Stapp joined us earlier. We're going to be taking a recess here in a moment after Representative Bynum. Go ahead.
Sure. Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. And so this benefit isn't only for a birthing mother, but my understanding is that if my wife were to have a child and I'm working, then I'm also eligible for this. Now, under current law, there's a requirement that says that I can leave my job and my job is held and protected, but there's my understanding is that there's no guarantee that I'm getting that income replacement. So as somebody that's working to try to support my family, there is definitely some pressure and motivation to say that I need to be working, right? And so if I'm a small business and I now, let's say my wife, I'm a small business, I'm not here, and my wife has a child and now I can leave my job for up to 26 months, or correction, weeks. I keep saying months. I'm sorry. Boy, I just like the idea, I guess, of 2 years off. But up to 6 months, basically, I can leave the job and I have income replacement. Mm-hmm. That creates quite a challenge, potentially, for small businesses. And I'm not saying that it's not a great idea that you have this bonding time and that the husband or partner is able to be home with the mother. and the child, but this could potentially be a scenario where both of them are receiving this benefit, could it not?
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, yes, it could be.
So the basis of my question is really to talk about that small business and what would the potential impact be.
Okay. So in the lineup, I have, for when we come back here, Representative Galvin, Tomaszewski, Allard, and Stapp. Did you have a...
I need to correct something.
Sure, Representative Stapp, go ahead.
So just for the record, through the chair, you get a, on your slide deck here, you say short-term disability. So short-term disability actually does cover pregnancy. It's classified as sickness. So your slide deck says limited application for family purchases beyond pregnancy complications. So that's with irrespective of complications, just to let you know.
What's the page?
Which page? Which page represents that?
I don't see pages on the slide deck. The third to the last.
All right, kinda.
Okay, maybe we can address that when we come back. So conference committee starting about now. So we'll take about a half hour or recess here in a moment, but I wanted to make a few announcements. So again, in the on the list for questions when we come back, I've got Representative Galvin, Tomaszewski, Allard, and Stapp. The other thing I wanted to mention is SB 39, loans under 25,000 payday loans. The Lake sent an amendment deadline for tomorrow. That's Saturday, May 17 at 5 p.m. With regard to SB 64, the elections bill, I'm going to be setting that aside. We gave it a shot. That, you know, thinking that we might be able to arrive at some consensus. But you know, we just simply can't do it in the short amount of time that we have to give it the proper due diligence that we need to get through both, you know, introduction all the way until passage. We've got many, many moving pieces in this bill, and just not feasible to think that we could knock it out by essentially tomorrow. You know, we still have to get through the amendments process. So I'll be setting SB 64 aside, and then when we come back in about half an hour, about around 4 o'clock, we will resume. I'm sorry?
That would be 5.
5 o'clock. Thank you. Time warp. End of session, time speeds up. So when we get back, we will continue on with this bill, which is HB 193, paid parental leave. And then the next bill after that, we've got HB 104. That's the address confidentiality program. We do have public testimony for that. And then the last bill of the day is HB 96, Home Care Employment Standards Advisory Board. So with that, the time is currently 4:30, and we'll recess until 5. That's back on record. The time is currently 5:47 p.m., and where we left off earlier is HB 193, that's unemployment benefits paid parental leave. And then after that bill, we have HB 104, address confidentiality program. And then after that, we've got HB 96, that's the Home Care Employment Standards Advisory Board. We do have public testimony on the address confidentiality program. So what I'd like to do is take a few more questions on the bill that's before us, and then I don't want to keep folks waiting for public testimony on the next bill too much longer. And so so we'll go to questions on this bill. The lineup that I had for the bill before us, I had Representative Galvin, then Tomaszewski, Allard, and Stapp. So with that, Representative Carolyn Hall, would you like to come up, as well as Mr. Tristan Walsh? And let's see here. I think I've got everything covered. And so with that, Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Through the chair, this is a question actually for the actuarials. I just want to make sure that I'm understanding the overall piece of this work that has been so well studied, and I'm really appreciating the good news of the slide here. Let me just look for that page number. But it really, this is page 14, I believe. Yes. So on this page, it shows us that our current state right now, as I understand it, is that our rate of tax for unemployment is at 1.5%. And with that already in place, and it has been in place for quite some time, as I understand, we are splitting that up with this new design. We're not adding any more taxes. In fact, for businesses, we're looking at a small decrement. So businesses will get a break here, as I understand it. And for the employee contribution, that is then going to get split. And both of them will be split and contributing to the paid parental leave, correct? Is that how this is designed? If you would, Tristan, or sorry, Mr. Wallace?
Mr. Walsh.
For the record, Tristan Walsh, staff to Representative Hall. Through the chair, Representative Galvin, you are mostly correct. The employee contribution and the chart reflected on page 14 of the PowerPoint. Currently, those employees are already contributing 0.35% towards the STEP program and the mm-hmm. TVAP program. Their contribution outlined in this chart is a new special contribution that would go towards the paid parental leave program. So that 0.15% is a new special contribution towards paid parental leave.
Thank you. And my understanding is the actuarial has done the work to determine that if we have, let's say, approximately 9,300 babies born per year, and if both parents even were to choose to appreciate this benefit, this fund in the state would still be solvent. The way this looks right now, you are predicting that we will not have any problems with our fund decreasing too much because it's been so over-funded up to this point. And is that correct so far?
Mr. Weller?
Good afternoon. Again, for the record, my name is Lena Weller, economist for the Department of Labor and Workforce Development and actuator for the UI Trust Fund. Through the chair, Representative Galvin, I can't necessarily speak to the ability of this revenue stream for this new program meeting maximum liabilities. However, that is a bit separate of a question from how it'll impact the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund. With respect to how this would impact funding for that program, it is true that this does take off a 1/1500ths of a percentage point tax that would otherwise go into the fund. However, as I did state earlier, the trust fund is quite overcapitalized. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the way our financing system accounts for benefit costs and target for the trust fund balance, that reserve ratio, it can absorb a whole range of costs and in fact, peeling off, in effect, an extra 1/1500ths of a percent from the employee and up to an additional 3/10ths from the employer would not be detrimental to the solvency of the UI trust fund.
Thank you. If I may follow up. Mm-hmm. And my understanding is there aren't many states with a UI trust fund like Alaska. So are there very many examples, I guess, of this creative way of funding this type of a family leave program?
Mr. Weller?
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, it is true that Alaska is one of only three states that has an employee contribution to UI funding, and that does and has opened up the door for other programs to be funded mm-hmm. via that mechanism. So it is special in that sense.
Yeah, and in the past, has funding STEP and TVEP ever been a problem, ever been, I guess, legally challenged in any way? Like, do you have any precedent for that? Are we feeling comfortable with this being legally allowable out of a UI trust fund? I don't know enough about it to know.
Through the chair, Representative Galvin. With respect to the employee contribution being diverted, that's been deemed to be in compliance with federal guidelines and regulations around how UI can be funded. With respect to the employer contribution, that's a separate issue that I think needs to be cleared up. My understanding is that employer contributions are not allowed to be diverted for any other purpose other than funding UI. But with respect to the employee contribution, they certainly can.
Mr. Walsh?
For the record, Tristan Walsh, staff to Representative Hall. Representative Galvin, through the chair, those are all good points. When we worked with Legislative Legal in drafting this legislation, it's really important to note that these are called special contributions. And so they are indeed separate contributions from the UI contribution that an employee makes right now but would no longer be making under this bill towards the UI fund. That new special contribution would go towards paid parental leave, and the employer would make a new special contribution towards paid parental leave. So the UI trust fund, when the state sees those deductions from an employer and administers them for the UI program, they're considered held in trust. And so those contributions are going to be accounted for separately under this legislation. So we are, in fact, creating two new special contributions towards paid parental leave. And that satisfied our attorney's concerns.
Great. Thank you. And I have two more follow-ups that are totally different that I'm hoping you all can help me or help share with all of us. One is about foster parents. My understanding is that this bill also is a preventative measure in terms of helping foster children grow a strong bond with parents, as well as if you have had the children biologically. And is there a period of time then before the child is born for foster children, foster parents to get ready, or is it just after the birth? And what does it look like in terms of coverage for paid parental leave for foster parents?
Mr. Walsh?
For the record, Tristan Walsh, staff to Representative Hall. Through the chair, Representative Galvin, under page 2 of the bill, I believe that we already are going to be treating it denotes one qualifying purpose is the anticipated birth of that child, and I believe that it would also cover the period including to and before adoption or foster placement, but we could also work with Legislative Legal to fine-tune that and ensure that sufficient protections are there.
That's great. That's wonderful. And then the last thing I have for you that I'm hoping you will share, if it's applicable, is if you've done any work in the area of how helpful this might be in terms of recruitment and retention, if other states have shared the good news that when you bring on a benefit like this, it's makes your state very attractive.
For the record, Tristan Walsh, staff to Representative Hall. Through the chair, Representative Galvin, that was actually a really interesting facet of, I guess we have been in our office calling this a sticky policy, where when it comes to retention and recruitment, we had a slide in the PowerPoint that mentioned the cost to a business when it comes to recruitment and retention. It's roughly 23.5% of that's employees' salary, and then as time goes on, the businesses face opportunity costs related to that vacancy, and so it's something that this committee has likely seen a lot over the past several years in discussing. And so the numbers that we've seen, it could save between 23.5% of that position or up to 150%.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, the list that I have from before we went to our recess earlier, I had Representative Tomaszewski, Allard, Stapp, Jimmy, and Bynum. So next up would be Representative Stapp.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Foster. Through the chair, to Representative Hall and staff, I actually really appreciate this bill. I want to let you know that. I will say some of these mechanics, I think, are going to need some deep thought. So on page 5, coordination of benefits, I'm going to kind of drill down a little bit here if I could, Mr. Co-Chair. So page 5, under coordination of benefits, we're looking at subsection B, which basically we're saying that payments for paid leave must be or can be made concurrently with coordinated payments of leave provided under a short-term disability policy or separate bank of PTO, right? So basically we are saying that the employee can collect paid leave from maternity on top of disability payments from if they have a disability policy or their PTO. And my question is going to be, have you consulted Division of Insurance regarding that mechanism? And the reason I ask that question is because typically disability policies, by federal law, like only reimburse 70% of the employee's wages. And if you're going to be able to collect PTO as well as short-term disability, as well as paid parental leave, it's highly likely that you're going to be collecting actually more than your total salary, through the chair.
Mr. Walsh?
For the record, Tristan Walsh, staff to Representative Hall. Through the chair, Representative Stapp, those are points well received. We had not talked specifically with the Division of Insurance. However, I think it is in the spirit of the bill. When you look down there in Section C, the next session, there were additional protections regarding to make sure that the amount received under this sort of compensation would not exceed their prior weekly earnings. And so I think that is a good conversation to entertain.
Fault, Mr. Co-Chair. Yeah, so just to check on that, and like I said, I'm not entirely sure if it's a violation of the policy standards. I will just say that in subsection C, it says if the total amount does not exceed the employee's average weekly earnings. And I think that's legally correct because, you know, what I always tell people is, you know, the reason the government caps the amount of money you can earn as turning your salary on a disability policy is because they don't want you to make more money outside of work than you were working. But I'm just curious. I do feel that you should spend a little bit of time maybe thinking about that mechanic and how it would actually implement with a private sector business, right? Because what's going to happen is a lot of people, especially in the private sector, are not going to understand that they have an employee that's on short-term disability that maybe be taking PTO and also claiming the benefit at the time. So, like I said, potentially maybe not a problem, but certainly something you might want to think about and investigate, through the chair.
Okay. Next up, I have Representative Jimmy.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster, and through the chair, thank you, Representative Hall, for bringing this bill forward. I just wanted to ask, are you able to walk us through how paid parental leave program might be particularly beneficial for families in rural Alaska where access to child care and support is limited?
Mr. Walsh.
For the record, Tristan Walsh, staff to Representative Hall. Through the chair, Representative Jimmy, that is actually one of the really fascinating benefits of this sort of policy. When we look at the cost of infant child care, even in urban Alaska, it can be very high. And then when you look at places where there is no access at all, this can actually help keep households economically sound and figure out the arrangements they may need to return to work eventually, but also take advantage of those really important bonding experiences with their newborn child, foster child, or adoptee.
Follow up. Could you explain a little bit more on the child care side? Because there, in many rural villages, there is no daycare center. There is no. The only way you can get it is through having family members be paid or somebody in the community.
For the record, Tristan Walsh, staff to Representative Hall, certainly. Through the chair, Representative Jimmy, this bill would essentially allow a family unit to receive income while they're taking care of their child instead of looking for what is likely very expensive child care. And so this bill would actually help a lot of new families be able to figure out how to get started.
All right. Oyana.
I've got Representative Bynum and then Stapp. Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. So I was just kind of a thought process on this. FMLA, there's provisions in FMLA that we currently have that already cover a lot of these things. The big difference is that in a lot of cases, the employer is not required to pay the employee when they're taking FMLA, but it has a right to protect their job. So I was just wondering why we wouldn't have just mirrored what the FMLA is doing, with the exception that you would then be eligible for protections for pay.
Mr. Walsh?
For the record, Tristan Walsh, staff to Representative Hall. Through the chair, Representative Bynum, those are points well taken. I think when we look at the policy outlined in the current bill and in from the prior committee, we're able to take advantage of a couple different pieces of infrastructure that we have when it comes to the unemployment insurance system and employers' present participation in that system regardless of size. When we look at FEMLA, there's certain restrictions where it may only apply to employers of a certain size and scale across a geographic area. And this seemed to kind of find that happy medium regarding how to do it, I guess.
Follow-up?
Thank you for a follow-up. So currently under law, there's many employers that have to comply with FMLA, but in the event that employee has to use that, they're injured or they meet one of the requirements here, many employers right now require that they actually use their accrued sick leave and vacation leave in conjunction with their FMLA if they want to receive pay. But then I look at here in the statute, and in here it's saying, not only do you get paid, you're not obligated to use that FMLA. So I'm just wondering how what's in federal law versus what we would be doing in this law, how those two things may or may not conflict. Has that been something that's been looked at and considered?
For the record, Tristan Walsh, staff to Representative Hall. Through the chair, Representative Bynum, we can certainly look more at federal law. I think when we're examining, for example, some of the language on page 5 regarding the coordination of benefits, this is where, when we're looking at the socioeconomic benefits of paternity leave at any given length, it is possible that a worker may not have the ability to roll over a certain number of accrued time year over year, and if we are able to take advantage of existing contributions from their employer and from that employee, we're able to create a much better benefit at what is essentially the same cost or reduced cost for that employer.
Thank you very much. And there's a lot to go through here, so I look forward to that opportunity as we go through the process. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, I've got Representative Stapp, and then we'll go to the fiscal notes with Mr. Anderson. Representative Stapp.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Foster, through the chair to Representative Hall or staff. I kind of want to compliment you guys on the breadth of knowledge here first on the presentation. So the topics you're dealing with are pretty complex, and I'm actually pretty impressed by your kind of understanding of the content. So on page 9, section 2310-7075, the federal tax withholding. So this is a bit of a tricky section. So typically on disability insurance, the tax tracking type on the deduction determines whether or not the benefits are going to be taxable, right? So if you pre-tax the benefits, or rather if you pre-tax the premiums, the benefits are typically considered taxable. But if the payroll deduction is done on an after-tax basis, typically the benefits are not considered taxable. So there's a couple of provisions here in this section of the bill that I'm curious to get your thoughts on. So for one, how do you envision the employer making the deduction? Is the employer looking to make the deduction for the plan on a pre-tax basis under a Section 125
or on an after-tax basis? Because I'm not an expert on this particular thing, but I can probably guarantee you that that would probably affect the tax tracking type through the chair.
Mr. Walsh.
For the record, Tristan Walsh, staff to Representative Hall. Regarding your question, and you think you mentioned, Representative Stapp, through the chair, you mentioned section 125?
Through the chair. It's page 9. It's it just says section 23.10.70.70, federal income tax withholding, that portion of the bill, through the chair.
For the record, Tristan Walsh, staff to Representative Hall. Through the chair, Representative Stapp, this is actually something that is, I think, relatively interesting. I had just been doing some research this morning. The IRS has issued recent guidance regarding the taxability of this sort of compensation, and so I believe that they are treating it the same way as they treat unemployment insurance contributions. And so they are considering the contributions to be taxable. And I, to, at the risk of going further, I would have to either get back to the committee or call a lifeline from the department.
Yeah, follow, Mr. Co-Chair.
Follow up?
Yeah, that's something, certainly something you want to look and advise. And like I said, I can only speak to how it kind of works on disability insurance. And like I said, typically if the premiums, in this case the value, the benefit, the contribution itself, that the benefits being taxable is determined by whether or not you are either using pre-tax dollars for the contribution or after-tax dollars. So that's something to consider. I will also say that some of these provisions regarding what the department is basically supposed to do in terms of withholding their potential federal income tax, on page 10, it talks about amounts deducted for federal income taxes and withheld from paid parental leave. I would be interested to see how that mechanic actually works, because it kind of sounds like that the department itself, because on page 9, subsection 3, it says the individual may elect to have federal income tax deducted and withheld from the individual's payment of paternal leave at the amount specified. It kind of sounds like the department is going to be the one who is actually holding the tax withholding on your behalf and then paying, and vice versa. And I'm not entirely certain if that's probably something we want the department to do, as opposed to just make the individual responsible for the liability in the event that they collect the tax, or they collect the benefit, if that makes sense, through the chair.
Mr. Walsh?
For the record, Tristan Walsh, staff to Representative Hall. Through the chair, Representative Stapp, those are points well taken. I know that the model policy that this legislation was initially crafted on was in part built off of the functions of unemployment insurance system, and I could defer to the Unemployment Insurance Division if this is the process for their current assessment of unemployment insurance contributions regarding their taxability.
Yeah, follow up, Mr. Co-Chair.
Representative Stapp?
Yeah, I'll end it here. Yeah, I am uncertain. I just certainly think that's something you want to probably take a look at. Thanks to the chair.
And who, Mr. Walsh, who should we refer to? Ms. Paloma Harbor?
For the record, Paloma Harbor with the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. I would have to look at the statute, the actual unemployment insurance statute. I know that we issue 1099 Gs for unemployment benefits, and I know that's the way we handle it. I am not aware that we do any tax withholdings on unemployment benefits, so I do think that is probably an area we want to look at with the sponsor.
Yeah, follow up, Mr. Critcher.
Representative Scott.
Yeah, just so you're aware, on page 9 of the bill and 10, that's kind of where it goes over that specific. Mm-hmm. And it certainly, it says at the bottom of page 9, the individual may elect to have the federal income tax deducted and withheld from the individual's payment of paid parental leave in the amount specified. Right. So you definitely probably want to think about that mechanic through the chair.
Agreed. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Galvin, did you have a question?
Very brief. I just want to check in. I think I heard you say that in this case, so far, this did not apply to independently owned businesses if it's a sole ownership. Is that correct?
For the record, Tristan Walsh, staff to Representative Hall. Through the chair, Representative Galvin, that is correct. When discussing initial drafts of this bill, including the prior committee with the department, they currently don't have the infrastructure for collecting unemployment insurance contributions from those sorts of businesses because they don't currently contribute.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. Representative Tomaszewski, did you have any questions on the bill for us? If you need to kind of get back into the swing of things, we can go to the next question if that's better.
No, I'm fine. Okay. I can ask.
Sure.
That.
Representative Tomaszewski.
Thank you, Chair Foster, through the chair. Sorry I'm late. I just had another bill hearing. So both parents are covered. It doesn't matter if they're married or not.
For the record, Tristan Walsh, staff to Representative Hall. To the chair, Representative Tomaszewski, correct. In a given household, either parent would be able to file this claim as they have also paid into the system, so they would be eligible for the benefit.
Okay, follow up.
Follow
up. And so I guess it's whoever signs. In the case where there was not a married couple, it's whoever puts their name on the paperwork at the hospital, that would be the person available for that. Okay. And so I was hoping to get the Department of Labor a question about their graphs, if someone would like to do that. In regards to page 2, the UI stress test scenario of HB 193. So this is the unemployment insurance fund on this graph that you have here.
Again, for the record, my name is Lennon Weller, economist with the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. Through the chair, Representative Tomaszewski, yes, all of these exhibits reflect UI financing, trust fund balance, benefit costs, average employer and employee tax rates.
Okay, follow up.
Representative Tomaszewski.
So in the presentation, we were developing, I thought, two different funds. One was the paid parental leave. The portion was going to this. And I kind of assumed that was another fund. And then some of the money from the employer went into the UI trust fund. Some of it went to the paid parental leave. I assumed it was a fund, but apparently it's the same fund. No. Okay.
Mr. Walsh?
For the record, Tristan Walsh, staff to Representative Hall. Through the chair, Representative Tomaszewski, we have on page 14 of the PowerPoint two separate and distinct funds. The paid parental leave fund, I believe, is created on page 2 or page 1 of the bill. And then we leave separate the UI trust fund. Under federal law, we are not going to be able to touch that fund because of our participation in the federal compact regarding it.
Okay, follow up.
Follow up.
So then the UA stress scenario, this was of the unemployment fund, but did this take into effect, I mean, were the paid parental leave payments coming out of in this stress test?
Mr. Weller?
Through the chair, Representative Tomaszewski, the impact to these figures would be from the diversion of the employees 0.15% not going into the trust fund, as well as the combined 0.3, the 0.2 from the employer for the paid parental leave program, and the additional 0.1% that's going to, I believe, the STEP program.
So,
in addition to all of the, I'm not sure if all of the assumptions were made explicit, but essentially this is a recessionary scenario. In terms of claims loads, in terms of changes to the employment and wages, that would, of course, affect tax revenues, and also the increase in the benefit schedule to $817 as well as the increase to $72 for the dependent allowance, both inflation adjusted.
So, Representative Tomaszewski?
Yes, so this does represent the paid parental leave payments or coming out of here, or this is just strictly a recession scenario?
Through the chair, Representative Tomaszewski, what this reflects is the impact to the unemployment insurance system from diverting additional revenue that otherwise would have gone to that program. It doesn't reflect benefit costs for the parental leave program. Those revenue streams essentially are fixed at those rates, and so at maximum, for example, you're looking at about $35 million annually for that three-tenths total tax. But see, essentially, that would be a revenue stream that could pay for those benefits. But this strictly reflects those additional diversions that otherwise would have gone into the UI trust fund, not having gone into the trust fund.
So those are the only variables in this scenario? Just the reduction of the...
Through the chair, Representative Tomaszewski, I incorporated all of the elements of the bill as it's currently written, applying, again, a recessionary impact to the UI system. So, yes, it does, to the extent that it reflects the paid parental leave program, it's simply the diversion of that revenue to this other program, in addition to the other factors that implicate the UI trust fund financing, that being the increase to the benefit schedule, as well as the indexing.
Follow-up, Representative Tomaszewski.
So thank you, Co-Chair Josephson, through the chair. So the next page, we have an increase in contribution rates, I'm assuming, to fortify the fund. So we go from 2026 to 2029, we're down $700 million. And then so because of that, in your scenario, we are increasing the employer contribution and employee contributions significantly somewhat in 2028, but then significantly in 2029. And in 2030, we kind of hit the high water mark in your scenario, which is basically a doubling of the tax because the employer is up to over 2% contribution and the employee is up about 50% of their original. Is that what this graph is showing?
Mr. Weller?
Through the chair, Representative Tomaszewski, yes, that is correct. The financing system is responsive to changes in costs at the most basic level, and this would occur under any sort of recessionary scenario, regardless of the bill.
Just one.
Sure. More. Representative Tomaszewski.
Thank you, through the chair. So you know what I would like to see? We have a really good example of a stress test on this fund just a few years back during COVID. I know we went from $550-600 million down to around $250 million a few years ago. I think that would be a great presentation, you know, that would show how the fund reacted to something as severe as COVID, where we had a massive increase of unemployment, and so that would be a great stress test that we've already have, and just to get that information out to the committee and to the sponsor, I think that'd be very helpful. Thank you.
All right, we next have Representative Bynum, then Hannon. Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson, through the chair. Yeah, I appreciate the representative from Fairbanks for bringing up the talk about the trust here, because we're talking about finances here for the most part. Is it possible for us to get a history, or at least the last five to ten years history of the trust, so we can get a better idea about what those rates were set at in order to maintain a level for a funded trust? The reason why I'm asking for that is because it's being characterized in this bill that we will have a tax cut, but when we look under the stress testing scenarios that Representative Tomaszewski was asking about, is that in the long term, it looks like a cut for 2 years or so, and then there's this immediate need potentially into the fund where we are putting those rates a lot higher. So I'd just be curious to see what the historical rates that were set under the before this law would go into effect are, and then get a better idea of why we would want to be removing money from the trust, or correction, from the, you know, all the monies coming in, and not putting that additional 0.2% into the trust to make sure that we're not going to have this immediate dip off and then this big increase to try to adjust for it.
And your question is to staff?
Yes, was to get the history of the fund so that we have a better evaluation of what it's actually been.
Mr. Walsh.
For the record, Tristan Walsh, staff to Representative Hall. We will work with the department to get that to you, sir.
Thank you.
Okay. We next have Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. And I believe it's Dr. Weller, isn't it? Didn't you finish your PhD? Or I shouldn't ask him that on the record. So we'll go with Mr. Weller until he's finished his PhD. Will you go through the stress test graph again? You explained it at the beginning of the presentation, and I think we now have a better understanding of the bill. So would you go through again or expand on the factors in that stress test that is leading to that growth in the bar graphs in 29 and 30?
Dr. Weller.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, I appreciate that. I don't, in fact, have a doctorate, just a master's degree.
Okay. All right. I saw graduation pictures somewhere.
I'd be happy to go through all of the elements here. So, and this also dovetails with Representative Tomaszewski's inquiry. I did, in fact, actually apply a scenario here that is actually more extreme in magnitude than the COVID impact that we had, reflective in part in terms of the duration of the impact of the increase in benefits. I went with a 3x essentially increase in claimants for approximately 3.5 years and applied a change in employment and wages exactly equivalent in percentage change to what we saw during the COVID period. So, in fact, I tried to stress the system, squeeze it, so to speak, quite a bit, and in fact, historical standards. What we're looking at here, if I started, say, with the reserve ratio, right now we're sitting at about 4.5%, 4.47% is what we had going into 2025. That was the value used to calculate tax rates for the current year that we're in. In fact, we're set to hit about 4.8. For rates to be set for 2026. But what we see is that what I did apply here, assuming the bill went into effect at the beginning of calendar year 2026, I applied the increase to the maximum weekly benefit amount from 370 to 817. I increased the dependent allowance per dependent to $72 from the current 24, a maximum of 3 dependents per claimant. I included the 0.15% additional diversion from the employee contribution to go to this new parental leave program. Included also the 0.2% from the employer's contribution going to the parental leave program, and the additional 0.1% that would then be diverted to STEP. Employing all of those and reducing the statutory minimum rate for employers to 0.5%, these are therefore then the results of that analysis out to 2035. As you can see, it takes a few years for these benefit costs, and that would be in the, 6 column over, beginning at about $45 million for the current year that was used, that increasing all the way to $350 million by 2029 in benefit costs, significantly higher, in fact, than what we saw during COVID on a single-year basis. we can see the resulting reserve ratios. And while they do fall quite substantially, I think it is a testament to the way that the system is financed that it can absorb quite a variation in benefit costs. And it does this because it incorporates both benefit costs paid and a reserve ratio target, again, that we've had in place in statutes since the early 80s and has been sufficient to handle the 80s recession, a couple of small recessions through the late 80s, the 90s, the 2000 recession, the 2008 Great Recession, financial collapse, and, of course, COVID.
Follow-up, Representative Hannon.
Thank you. I'm just going to reprise the opening line. Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson, that you used, applied all the factors as if the bill had passed and used three times the number of claimants for a duration of 3 years before we see a need to add some more money back to the fund. So thank you for walking us through that.
Okay. We now have Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. And this is a question about STEP and TVEP, because that is we don't sit in either labor or we don't really know a lot about those funds, and so I'm just wanting to ask you to cover the 0.35 and the 0.10. Is that what we've been traditionally putting in as it is? Are we changing this or growing it? And what does these two things do, just for those who maybe don't know about STEP and TVEP and want to make sure that that fund is protected or the work that is being done is protected?
Mr. Walsh.
For the record, Tristan Walsh, staff to Representative Hall. Through the chair, Representative Galvin, those are good questions. If we look at the graphs on, on page 13, it would show the current existing structure of our unemployment funding system. The state employee training program currently has 0.1% contribution from employees, and then they also have an additional 0.15% contribution that goes towards the TVEP program, totaling 0.35%. This bill, and you'd see the change on page 14, you'd see an additional 0.1% going towards the STEP program, and that is in part to help accommodate the need to get folks trained up and back to work.
Thank you. So to be clear, it's going to be getting a bit more funding, and the idea is that we will have more opportunities for using that fund to help train Alaskans to get back to work or get to work. Thank you very much.
Mr. Anderson, can you come up and walk us through the fiscal notes?
For the record, Brody Anderson, staff to Representative Neil Foster. Before the committee are three fiscal notes, starting with the Department of Administration, Appropriation, Centralized Administrative Services, Allocation, Finance, OMB component number 59, control code KVTIV. Before you, in this fiscal note, reflects a zero fiscal note. The Department of Administration and the division have acknowledged that they can absorb all additional workload with existing resources, and they have submitted a zero fiscal note. The next fiscal note before the committee is from the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. Appropriation is Employment and Training Services. Allocation is Unemployment Insurance. OMB component number 2276, control code SVTSY. Before the committee today is a fiscal note asking for FY26 appropriations of $379,500 for personal services, $137,400 of services, $8,200 of commodities for a total operating cost of $525,100. That would be coming from the DGF fund of Designated General Fund Temporary Fund Code 1252 for that same cost of the appropriation. There will be changes in revenue reflected in this. The STEP fund will have a $10 million shift. And also in DGF temporary, it shows that there's an increase of $35 million. The department has also recognized that this will require regulation changes. In personal services costs, the $379,500 annually for different various staffs that are in services, $137,400 in FY26, and then it will go down into $101,400 annually in FY27 and beyond. This accounts for a one-time developer cost in FY26, one-time testing, remediation, and production and implementation for FY26, ongoing information and technology maintenance costs annually after that. In commodities, the $8,200 in FY26, and then in FY2029, there'll be $1,200 for all other fiscal years. This accounts for $1,200 of supplies and equipment, $7,000 in FY26, and in FY29's purchase to replacement of old computers. That summarizes that fiscal note. The final fiscal note before the department, before the committee, is the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. Appropriation, workers' compensation, allocation, workers' compensation, OMB component 344, control code HDCOL. This reflects an FY29 appropriation request of $743,300 of personal services, $344,300 of services, $18,000 of commodities, grants and benefits of $12,479,300 for a total operating cost of $13,584,900. This is all coming from the fund source of 1252 DGF temporary. This fiscal note reflects that there will be five positions added, and there'll be a change of revenue of an increase of $15 million. This also reflects that there will require regulation changes to accomplish this. In personal services, there'll be the cost reflects two accountant technicians and one project assistant, one appeals officer, and one hearing officer. In services, $344,300 in FY26, dropping down to $125,000 in out years, the cost of modifying similar in-house programs to track and administer claims included in FY26. Commodities is $18,000 annually, and then the grants and benefits is your $12,479,300 per the department's UI actuarial economist. Mr. Chairman, that summarizes the three fiscal notes, and I do believe that the department is prepared to answer any questions for these fiscal notes.
Thank you.
I'd like to have a brief at ease.
Yes, I'm just about to set the bill aside also, so we're going to take a brief at ease. Okay, House Finance back on record. The time is 6:42 p.m. and the date is Friday, May 16th, 2025. So we had a fiscal note. It sounds like there's an updated fiscal note. Mr. Anderson?
Yes, thank you. Once again, for the record, Brody Anderson, staff to Representative Neil Foster. There is a new fiscal note that was submitted on 5/12. It is for OMB component 344. The control, there will be a new control code as well for it. It is for the workers' compensation. There is some substantial cost differences in that one. The grand total for that fiscal note is closer to $34.4 million. So at this point, I just would like to let the Finance Committee know that we will distribute that fiscal note, and then we can review it at the next fiscal, at the next time this bill comes up for review.
Okay, great. Okay, thank you very much. I think we're going to set this bill aside for now. Representative Hall, thank you very much for presenting this. Mr. Walsh. We've been losing some folks. The day is getting long, and I know that people have got other things going on. And so with regard to the next bill that we were supposed to have, which is HB 104, Address Confidentiality Program, we're going to push that bill to the morning 10 a.m. meeting. So we'll take that up at 10 a.m. A couple of the key folks that were going to help present the bill were not available tonight. So we will set that one aside for now. And again, we'll take that up in the morning. And that takes us to the third bill that we had for today, and that is HB 96, Home Care Employment Standards Advisory Board. And if we could have Representative Prox and his staff, Mr. Riley Nye, come up to the table. After we get the introduction, then we will go to the invited testimony. And it looks like maybe it's just one person. And then we will go to the fiscal note and also available for questions we have in the audience with us, Mr. Tony Newman from Department of Health, Division of Senior and Disability Services. So, Representative Prox, thank you very much for staying with us through the long haul here.
Yeah. Thank you, Chair Foster. Mike Prox, representing District 33, the North Pole Badger Road area, and thank you to the committee for taking your time to hear HB 96, an act establishing the Home Care Employment Standards Advisory Board, and also relating to payment for personal care services and providing for an effective date. So I'm just going to try and keep this as short as I can, hit the high points. Alaska is facing an increasing number of senior citizens and others needing home care and services, and that is outpacing the supply of people available to provide those services. And that's kind of one of the drivers for this act, and it is also being driven by a proposed change in the federal Medicare regulations that are going to require an advisory board to help set the rebasing, as they call it, of those states, of those rates. And with us tonight is Tony Newman, the Director of Senior and Disability Services, and we may or may not, I'm not sure, have some other expert on the line to answer any questions for that. And the bill, in a nutshell, it creates an advisory board. It describes the term of office for those members, the composition of the board, the powers of the board, and provides for them to provide a biannual report on what they have accomplished and some definitions. And I would prefer, I guess, to drop it there and answer any questions that you might have, and we might call on Mr. Newman or someone else for the detailed questions.
Great, thank you. I think we're supposed to have as invited testimony Alexis Rodich. I don't believe Alexis is on the line. Oh, we do have, okay. This should be, I don't see. Alexis Rodich, if you're on the line, would you please put yourself on the record, just state your name and your affiliation, and proceed with your invited testimony on House Bill 96?
Thank you. Yes, I am on the line. Excuse me. My name is Alexis Rodich, and I'm with the Elastic Caregivers Union, SEIU 775.
And maybe if you could get a little bit closer to the mic just so we can hear you a little better.
Sure, thank you. Is this better?
Yes, we can hear you better. Thanks.
Okay, great. My name is Alexis Rodas, and I'm with the Alaska Caregivers Union, SEIU 775.
What was the last part?
Excuse me?
Were you providing invited testimony?
Yes, I am. Shall I begin?
Oh, yes, please.
Okay, great. Thank you. So, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here today to talk about HB 96. As I said, I am with the Alaska Caregivers Union. We represent more than 55,000 direct care workers in Washington, Montana, and Alaska. We're deeply committed to a strong and sustainable system of long-term services and supports in Alaska and believe that HB 96 is an important bill to that end. As many of you know, our state has been experiencing a massive demographic shift that is driving up demand for care and for higher skilled care in particular. Over the last decade, Alaska has had one of the fastest growing senior populations per capita in the country, a trend that is expected to continue over the next decade. Older Alaskans and Alaskans with disabilities are living longer, which is, of course, a good thing. However, with age comes higher acuity and more complex care needs. Many of the caregivers that we work with have children with developmental disabilities who are living longer than they ever expected, and they ask, what's going to happen when I'm gone? Similarly, Alzheimer's and other dementias are also on the rise, which creates higher demand for paid and unpaid care services. Given these demographic changes, it is no surprise the Department of Labor and Workforce Development predicts that home care will be one of the fastest growing and in-demand occupations in the state, yet at the very same time, the number of potential caregivers, that is working age adults between 18 and 64, is in decline, going from 15 to 1 in 2018 to 7 in 2030. The shortage is even more stark in rural and remote areas of the state. A higher concentration of older Alaskans live in Southeast Alaska and on the peninsula than any other part of the state. They've built lives and have families and don't want to move to Anchorage or out of state in order to get the care they need as they age. And I know that no one in this committee wants them to either. And we certainly don't want them forced to move into an institution or congregate care setting, which can cost the state hundreds of thousands more per year per person. The workforce crisis will only get worse and far more costly for the state unless we start taking steps now to ensure we have a strong, well-trained professional direct care workforce. HB 96 helps accomplish this in two ways. First, it makes sure that the state is maximizing the Medicaid personal care rate by creating a, quote, labor rate for personal care services. That is, a percent of the Medicaid rate that agencies receive for PCA services must go directly to the pay and benefits of direct care workers. In a state like Alaska, where almost all personal care services are provided through a consumer-directed, quote, agency with choice model, far less of the Medicaid rate needs to go to agency overhead because agencies have far fewer responsibilities than a traditional agency model. It is the consumer, not the agency, that is responsible for recruitment, scheduling, training, hiring. So it is fair that a substantial amount of the rate, in this case 70%, should be going to pay for services, not overhead. HB 96 also creates much more transparency around how the Medicaid personal rate is being used. Over the past few years, caregiver after caregiver flew to Juneau, met with members of this body, called into public testimony to hear how the Medicaid rate kept their pay low and made it impossible for them to make ends meet without picking up extra jobs or juggling bills or going into debt. This body listened and responded with multiple rate increases, two of which expressed legislative intent that some of the rate increase go to caregiver pay and benefits. Some caregivers, like those who now have a union, did get those pay increases, as much as $2 to $4 an hour, which is a huge relief if you've only been making $15 an hour. But many more did not, and no one really knows how the agencies use those recent rate increases because it's not, the data does not seem to be collected or analyzed. The second way that HB 96 strengthens long-term care workforce is that it creates a workforce standards advisory board. This board, modeled in part after similar entities in Nevada and Washington, brings stakeholders most impacted by the home care system, that is providers, caregivers, clients, and the Department of Health, together to identify and plan for the long-term workforce needs and assess whether the rates are adequate to meet those needs. A board like this one, like the one proposed in this bill, creates a vehicle for each group of stakeholders, all of whom have a unique and invaluable expertise on the care system in our state, to work together to identify priorities, recommend solutions, and assess whether we are adequately resourced or need to plan ahead. The demographic changes that I referenced earlier are already underway, and the caregiver shortage is already sorely felt. We've heard wrenching stories of caregivers needing to move their loved ones to Anchorage in order to get the care, their care needs met, or someone quitting their job to provide unpaid care to a loved one to access paid services. HB 96 is an opportunity to make a different choice for Alaska, one that will be far less costly for the state in the long term and for Alaskans who need care now or down the road. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. Do we have any questions for Ms. Rodich, Representative Jimmy?
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster, and through the chair. Hello, Alexis. It's nice to hear you again. It's been a while. I hope all has been well. But I remember speaking with you. You said in your remarks that you said that congregate care settings cost the state more money per year. Could you please explain how that works?
Yes, through the chair. Thank you, Representative Jimmy. Good to hear your voice as well. To answer your question, yes, a 2019 study by the Department of Health found that care provided in the home costs 59% less than services received through intermediate care facilities for individuals with intellectual or developmental disabilities. And that same study found that home care services can cost 45 to 90% less than nursing home care for seniors and people with disabilities. But to use real numbers, in FY24 and fiscal year 24, the average cost per individual for in-home personal care services under the state plan was $13,265 compared with $143,000 for care in nursing homes. It's a pretty substantial difference. And I would just love to add that investing in home care not only provides significant savings to the state, but it actually also boosts the economy. There is a pretty well-known study by Leading Age that found that every additional dollar in pay to a direct care worker has a multiplier effect in the community of 1.6 to 2.1. So every dollar that you're paying the community almost doubles its impact in the local economy. And there's demand for care workers all over the state. So home care can really make a big difference, both in economies locally, all around the state. So it saves money and it grows the economy.
Thank you.
Okay. Do we have any further questions for Ms. Rodich? I don't see any. He's back. So we'll go to questions for either the sponsor or Mr. Newman. Do we have any other questions? Okay, seeing none, maybe the fiscal note, Mr. Anderson.
Oh, sorry.
Oh, sure, Representative Jimmy.
Uh-huh. This is to Director Newman.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Tony Newman, if you could come up and put yourself on the record.
Good evening, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Tony Newman. I'm the director of the Division of Senior and Disability Services at the Alaska Department of Health.
Great, thanks. Representative Jimmy.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster, and through the chair. Thank you for being here, Director Newman. My question to you is, in rural Alaska, what options for care exist for those in need, and are they being met?
Through the chair, Representative Jimmy, thank you for the question. Definitely there is a greater need in rural Alaska for home care services such as personal care services, residential habilitative services like group homes and so on. I don't have specific numbers in front of me at the moment. What we are trying to do, a number of different things. We are, last session, this legislature, the legislature passed a bill for a new service called adult host home care, which was a way to develop a type of setting that was something less than an assisted living home that would make it easier for more, for smaller home settings to be able to become licensed and develop the services that people could need so they'd be able to stay in the rural communities. That regulations for that bill that was passed in 2023 have been under development. We also, with the Alaska legislature's help, created an allowance for legally responsible individuals to be able to be paid to provide certain kinds of care, personal care primarily. So a legally responsible individual, a parent, a spouse, who normally wouldn't be allowed to be paid to provide care, would be allowed to be paid to provide care. And we're hopeful. We've allowed that to continue past the public health emergency where it was originally introduced, and we've allowed it to continue. But we're still developing regs to make that a permanent feature of Alaska's healthcare offerings for people so that they can remain in their home communities and find services when they might not otherwise be able to through a regular agency. So there's a couple of steps that we're trying to take to reach rural Alaska better.
I hope this stuff.
Representative Jimmy.
Sorry. Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. I really do hope this does become permanent because it's really hard for elders to leave the village, and when you get out of their own settings where the food they're used to eating and interacting with family, to be taken away is really hard to see. But my auntie Bessie went through this program where my cousin could take care of her, and before I knew the name of it, I would call the Auntie Bessie Care. So I really hope this continues in Alaska. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Anderson, can you put the fiscal note on the record? Thank you, Mr. Newman.
Thank you for the record. Brody Anderson, staff to Representative Neil Foster. Before the committee today is fiscal note for the Department of Health, Appropriation, Senior and Disability Services, Allocation, Senior Disabilities and Services Administration, OMB component number 2663, control code POXLB. This fiscal note shows FY26 appropriation of the following. Personal services, $132,300. Travel, $2,000. Services, $24,000. Commodities, $5,000. For a total operating cost in FY26 for $163,300. This will come from $81,600 of federal receipt authority and then $81,700 of general fund match, for a total of the $163,300. In FY26, it'll increase one position. Then just addressing the changes into FY27, they will add another position, so the personal services would go up to $270,200. Travel would stay the same at $2,000. Services would go up to $48,000. Commodities would jump up to $7,000 for that year. Then the operating cost would be $327,200. And you see the reflected increases in both general fund and unrestricted general match. This fiscal note requires regulation changes that the department will have to conduct. The department plans on bringing one full-time health program manager on in FY26 and then a secondary position another health program manager in FY27. And then the services, you'll see the increase for those positions increased. But then, and also with the commodities for each one of those positions, and then the one-time commodity costs of $3,000 in the 2 years those positions come on board. Mr. Chairman, that summarizes the fiscal note before the committee, and I know the department is here to answer questions.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this is a little bit, this is actually not about the fiscal note, if I might ask.
Oh, sure.
The sponsor. Thank you. So I was wondering, I had an elder in our community, and actually she and her husband have since passed away, but they were both retired teachers, and they had some kind of private, you know, insurance through their work. And they had some kind of, you know, someone come in that did home health, but it wasn't Medicaid. It was through, you know, whatever, it was another program. Anyway, I mean, her biggest concern, and she talked to me at length about it for multiple years, was that, and even though she was in her 80s, she was afraid to leave her husband alone with, even when there was a attendant there, because they hadn't been trained in any way, even in, you know, getting them up and walking around with a belt or, you know, anything like that. And so would this cover anything to do with anything that's private, or would this all be Medicaid type a care attendance that it would cover?
Mm-hmm. Very good question. This specific bill just applies to Medicaid services offered, but it stands to reason that if the standards of care are more clearly defined per how much you're going to pay and whatnot, that the standards of care, I would think, would spread out then to others providing the care. But this specifically just applies to Medicaid.
Representative Johnson.
Yeah, and I appreciate that maybe know all the details of this, and I looked into it. It's been a number of years now, but I know I kind of looked into it, and that was kind of the hitch in it. And maybe if with the indulgence of the chair, perhaps there's someone from one of the departments that could answer. But because it's not necessarily state funded, it would be private insurance. That there wasn't. I didn't know exactly where to go with trying to get those standards in place. And so anyway, I was just trying to follow up a little bit and probably close the loop on something that, you know, I really should have tried to find out more about.
Mm-hmm. Representative Brox, did you have?
Well, as I say, this probably will result in more standardized care. As a result of clarifying what it means to Medicaid. But you can get these services through long-term care insurance. That is awful difficult to afford. But there's quite a few people that might not have long-term care insurance, but they're not qualified for Medicaid. So that would be an in-between market. This doesn't address that directly, but I hope that will eventually help people.
Representative Johnson? Sorry.
Well, I just want to say that I know that this is something that needs some kind of examination of and look at it. I mean, even Medicaid or long-term care insurance funded or whatever, I mean, there's just not, I don't know that there's real been a lot of hard look put at how to make sure that this is a work. First of all, we recognize we got a problem and we don't have enough, you know, we don't have enough facilities, and it's better off to have people at home. And then the second part of it is actually having people, you know, whatever level of training that they should have, that we can kind of make that happen. So I guess I can understand just trying to get something in place to start and then, you know, move into the next level. But anyway, I appreciate that.
Okay. We'll go to Representative Bynum, and then we'll close out for the night. Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Representative Prox, thank you for bringing this bill forward. I think that you're really focused on something here that's needed. And I know coming from you that this will have a benefit to Alaska, and the money that we're putting into it is something that we'll get a return on that investment. And I'm confident that you've done a lot of homework on this. So I guess that my biggest question has to do with we pass hypothetical scenarios that we end up passing this bill, and the funding that's in the fiscal note, that those positions aren't necessarily filled. What do you think that does for our ability to effectively execute the requirements of the bill?
Through the chair, Representative Prox, through the chair to Representative Bynum. If this is your question, if this doesn't get funded this fiscal year?
If we don't fund what's in this fiscal note, what will it do to impact what's happening in your bill?
Well, again, through the chair, I think it would delay developing the regulations, and then it depends on what eventually comes out of the federal government. It could put the squeeze on getting this set up in time for the expected federal regulation to take effect.
Follow up?
Do you think that there's any way that the Department of Health would be able to shift priorities and be able to actually execute this high-priority need if for some reason that there was a shortfall in their budgeting? Obviously, you understand that our budgets are very tight. This is very important. And I know a lot of times the tendency is for departments, when they give us fiscal notes, they're like, oh, it's just going to take another person. So they're reprioritizing what mission they have in front of them. So.
Right. Thank you. Through the chair, I think that would be Mr. Newman's question.
Mr. Newman?
This is Tony Newman from the Division of Senior Disability Services. Through the chair, Representative Bynum, as Representative Prax mentioned, there is a new federal rule. It's called the Medicaid Insuring Access Rule that is makes a requirement that we establish an advisory board, similar to what this bill creates, and it also that we eventually address the need to ensure that personal care workers and other types of home health care workers receive 80% of the Medicaid rate that we pay to an agency that provides those services. That particular aspect of the rule is not due to be enforced right now until 2030. So by July of 2026, according to the Medicaid Access Rule as it now stands, we're supposed to establish this advisory group. We would just have to see what we're able to accomplish if the bill were not to pass and we were unable to hire a position to help us work that job. We would just do our best to try and stand up that board in time to meet the federal requirement. I will say that we were expecting guidance from the federal government on implementation of this and many other aspects of this federal rule that I've mentioned. It's a big rule with many, many aspects that are meant to be met over a period of many years. So we have some immediate tasks that we have to do right now as far as the establishment of the advisory board goes. That's over a year from now. And we would be spending the next year trying to determine how we could find the staff to do that work. But then the work of establishing the 80% rule by 2030 would have to occur over time.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Through the chair, Mr. Newman, I have a very quick question for you. You were referring to the federal requirements access to care with an 80% rule. This bill asks for 70%. I assume you're thinking of stepping in. Is that why it's at 70 instead of 80? That's my question.
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, if the bill states that we'll be at 70%, I think, by 2026,
yeah.
And then by 2036, at least 80%, according to the version of the bill I have, at least that we would hit the 80% rule by 2036 in the bill.
Okay.
Like I said, the federal government currently has that expectation at 2030.
Great. Thank you very much. I just didn't see that in the sectional analysis, but that was my miss. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Okay. Representative Parks, do you have anything else? I was thinking about setting an amendment deadline. Do you have any other information? Comments,
well,
I suppose?
I think that pretty well covers it, of what we're trying to accomplish. I think this is something that is probably worth doing, whether it was a federal law driving this or not. And I think it will, well, it's hard to say. These are forward-looking statements, if you will. But I think that there is certainly enough room between personal care services right now and skilled nursing facilities that if this increases the supply of personal care services, there's probably going to be a net savings. I think there's a good reason to expect that less demand on skilled nursing facilities. And I suppose you should, not to denigrate the personal care services, but you might say the appropriately skilled services rather than someone that might actually be overqualified if you're not, you don't necessarily need to be a licensed practicing nurse or something like that to provide the care. So okay. I think it's really going to provide a lot better service, especially in the rural areas, or we're going to probably save some bucks over the long term.
Thank you. I'd like to set an amendment deadline for tomorrow, which is Saturday, May 17 at 5 p.m. With flexibility, because it's it's a short. So we've heard the bill once. I'm not hearing any major pushback. Doesn't sound like anybody might have amendments. But if anybody does think of anything, we're flexible with that amendment deadline. If folks need more time, and somebody who maybe is not here, and they decide that they have an amendment, we're willing to work with them. So we'll set a semi-firm amendment deadline for tomorrow at 5 on. And that's on this bill, which is HB 96. Thank you. Home Care Employment Standards Advisory Board. And then in terms of tomorrow, tomorrow there's a LBNA meeting at 9. So we have set tomorrow's finance meeting for 10 a.m. We do have floor at 11. We've got 4 bills in finance that we'd like to address tomorrow. So we'll have to kind of scatter that throughout the day. But we've got, we're going to come back to the bill that we skipped a little while ago, which was HB 104, Address Confidentiality Program with Representative Mears. So we'll do that first. They think it might be fairly short, and then we'll go into the other three bills that have been noticed, and that's SB 54, the Architects and Interior Design Bill, then SB 137, Extension of the Boards for Midwife, Nursing, Veterans, Parole Boards. And then SB 132, that's the omnibus insurance bill, and that's pending referral. So if there's nothing else to come before the committee, we'll be adjourned at 7:15 p.m. Thank you.